Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 29th of September. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
We're coming to you from the beautiful Zambia, where it's a balmy 37 degrees. Right in the middle of summer down here in the Southern Hemisphere, which is one heck of a contrast to the weather I left on Friday in the UK. How are you feeling, Kev?
Yeah, I'm feeling tired because we flew overnight, so it's tiring.
But jet lag's kicking in, isn't it?
Nah, not so much jet lag because the time hasn't happened, but it's just tiring, especially when you fly at night, so yeah.
All overnight flights, yeah. So obviously, before we talk about why we're down here, let's have a look at some of the stories that have dominated the headlines this week. We've seen the Labour Party's annual conference in your hometown of Liverpool concluded with significant debate over key policies, setting the stage for the challenges facing Sir Keir Starmer's government. One of the most contentious moments came with a non-binding vote where Labour members backed a Unite Trade Union motion calling for the reversal of cuts to the winter fuel allowance. Despite the pressure, ministers reaffirmed their stance on keeping the cuts in place, with Chancellor Rachel Reeves emphasising the need for tough fiscal decisions to rebuild the economy. So a little bit of revolt there, Kev, but I don't think it's any surprise that they're going to continue with that. There's quite a few other things that they underscored, ambitious housing plans, and I think we've talked about this, that they think they can build 1.5 million homes by 3 months. However, concerns were raised about the practicality of delivering on this target, especially given industry challenges like construction skill shortages and local authorities' capacity. What do you make of that one, that 1.5 million? I mean, that's just baloney, isn't it?
Absolute baloney. They have absolutely zero chance of doing this. And to be honest, if I remember back in the noughties and the 2010s, the Conservatives also were saying, we're going to build 1.5 million or 1 million new houses every year. Nobody's ever done it yet. And planning's stopping it for sure. And also, the builders don't want to build too many houses, because if they build too many houses, then they don't get the premiums that they want for them.
Yeah.
So it's not going to happen. It doesn't matter what they do. And the only way would be to go back to a 1950s, 1960s scenario where the government themselves built tens upon tens of thousands of council houses.
Yep.
Are they going to do that? No.
No,
no chance. So don't see it happening.
No, absolutely. The other thing that mentioned was the NHS. Obviously, we've seen massive underfunding in the NHS. A focal point there, with ministers stressing the need to address underinvestment and prioritise prevention. Health Secretary Wes Streeting emphasised empowering local NHS trusts and using regulation to reduce demand for services. So I think the take-home was that they really are going to highlight Labour's focus on the tough trade-offs, fiscal discipline and mission-led governance, but questions remain about the feasibility of actually delivering on all of these.
When's the budget coming?
Budget's in November, isn't it?
So we've got 4 or 5 weeks and then we're going to have the budget.
End of October, I think. So Rachel Reeves is going to obviously plan that one out, and it'll be interesting to see. But yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see, because there's a lot of talk on the board, isn't there, about capital gains tax going up to 50%. Inheritance tax going to be, they're going to change the threshold on inheritance. And then the other one was we talked about, was AIM, wasn't it? Removing EIS. What are your thoughts on how that'll affect the already sort of dying AIM market?
Well, it's not going to help it, is it? I don't know whether it was the EIS or some other tax system that was involved, but there was talk that they would take away the inheritance tax free bit, I think it was, as well. I think anyone with money, as in wealth, they're going to try and hit them, and that's what's going to happen. And it's a Labour government, so you shouldn't be surprised.
No, not at all. Did you? I mean, it's all kicking off now in Israel. Obviously, we talked about this last week. On Friday, it looked like there was a big incursion there. The Israel military has claimed responsibility for targeting Hezbollah's central command in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Daniel Hagari, the military spokesman, stated the command centre has embedded within civilian areas, and Hezbollah-affiliated at Al-Manar TV reported multiple Israeli airstrikes in the area. I mean, the images of the crater, I don't know if you've seen them, but it's leveled like 6 big apartment blocks, okay? It's taken them out in Beirut. Is this going down the same route as Gaza and leveling that, you know, indiscriminate bombing now? I mean, I know it was targeted to try and just basically finish Hezbollah off and take out a lot of the leaders, but it feels like they're in the same as Hamas, and they're hiding in civilian infrastructure, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, this has happened before in Lebanon. It's nothing new. You know, if you go back, I think, to the late 90s, was it? When there was hostages as well, if you remember. And, Israelis bombed to try and sort out Hezbollah or whatever faction.
Terry Waite was one of them, wasn't he?
Terry Waite, that's right. Hezbollah or whatever faction of the Iranian government, basically, is sat there. No, we've got friends in a place called Damour, which is about 15 kilometers just outside Beirut. Fortunately, the village hasn't had any bombs yet, but there was something that exploded within, I think it was sort of a kilometer of them, and obviously they were absolutely petrified of it, you know. So, yeah, they've taken in quite a lot of the people who fled from the south, because the south just geographically is away from Beirut. More towards Sidon, I think it is. And a lot of those people, you know, you saw traffic jams and all sorts of things of them coming back. And Lebanon has had absolute economic chaos for the last 18 years.
And also when the port went up, there's nitrate. I mean, that's they've never really recovered from that, have they, in terms of rebuilding the economy and all the issues with fuel and electricity. So you've got a feel for the Lebanese right now.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. A very cultured place. It's an amazing place. I've been 3 or 4 times to Lebanon, and a beautiful place both in the summer and the winter. It's on the Mediterranean coast.
And a lot of them are fleeing now, aren't they? I think they were saying that the journey from Beirut to wherever they're escaping, I think over the border, was normally 1.5-hour drive. It was taking 14 hours to do those drives, to evacuate now.
Well, an awful lot of Syrians had fled into Lebanon. To escape the war in Syria, and there comes another one. So imagine how they're all feeling as well. And I mean, the big community that is around Hezbollah, though they're not Hezbollah, is the Palestinians. And they're the Palestinians that live in Lebanon, who were basically fled in 1947 as well. So some stayed in Gaza, some stayed in the West Bank, some fled to Jordan, some fled to Lebanon, et cetera, and obviously some went as far as Syria as well. But, I've been in that community there in just outside Beirut. It's not a pleasant place. But, you know, they're all people.
Yeah.
I think we've got to, people have got to start realizing that these people are getting slaughtered.
Yeah.
And I mean,
at what point I know it's easy for us to say, what point does the rest of the global, the rest of the world get involved and try and stop this? I mean, Biden's been pretty weak-willed. I know he could have put more incursions on them and taken away some of their agreements, maybe embargoed things like some of the trade. But it just feels like not enough people have got behind them and stopped Israel from doing this.
No, I mean, it will be judged in the future, I'm sure. But they see Netanyahu as a war criminal, full stop.
I mean, he's over at the moment at the UN in New York. In fact, they said on Friday that he had to leave, exit sharp from the meetings to obviously go and be briefed on the security, all the issues that happened on Friday afternoon. So, I mean, surely they're going to be putting pressure on him there, the rest of the world. I mean, I know David Lam, he's been shouting, saying, come on, guys, we've got to get to some sort of, this is not on. But whether or not I don't know. I mean, he's popularity wise, I think Netanyahu is on thin ice, isn't he? In terms of
lot of the Israeli people.
Do you think it's the younger gens that are more against it than the older sort of?
Possibly, but you've also got to understand that this is not the Jewish people as such. There's I shouldn't use descriptive words in that way, but a big part of the Jewish community are very much against the violence that's happening.
Yeah.
Yes, they don't want to be bombed and killed themselves in Israel. And, you know, if they could just live in peace, that's what they want to do.
Yeah.
And they're not letting them do that.
This is about Zionism, though, surely.
But this is about Zionism, as you say.
Yeah.
I mean, and Zionism is a very different thing than Judaism.
Let's move on to our guest this week. We're joined by Alan Green, CEO of Brand UK. Alan's career began in marketing and advertising, but his passion for financial markets led him to become an active small cap stock trader. In the early 2000s, he co-founded Share Trading and Community website alongside former BBC journalist Malcolm Stacey.
After growing the platform, they successfully sold it to a fund management company. Alan has also written regularly for Yahoo Finance and launched Brand Communications, Brand UK, gaining a strong list of retail broking clients and listed companies. Today, Alan is a familiar voice in the financial media space with regular appearances on leading podcasts and financial media channels. So welcome to the Rose, Alan. I can't believe it's your first one. Great to have you on.
It's great to be here, Phil and Kevin. Yeah, many thanks for that very flattering introduction there.
Absolutely. I mean, just talk us through your journey from that, as you mentioned, as I alluded to at the top there, from this marketing and advertising role to the financial markets. What first got you involved in the finance?
Well, I started...
By the way, Alan, just before you start, Phil always makes you have to live up to this introduction as well. So.
Okay. I do have quite a good story. So in the late 90s, I read a book by Malcolm Stacey called Armchair Tycoon, which was a bestseller at the time. Malcolm's a former BBC journalist. He does, of course, still write for Share Profits, and he's still very active in the markets, and I speak to Malcolm regularly. But he was that book that just really kind of piqued my interest. At the time, I was working for a directory company, funnily enough. So I wasn't in the space, but started buying and selling shares, tracking share prices on CFAX. Do you remember that, when you had to wait for the share price to come
back? 50th anniversary. So you're right on that. It's very, very apt right now, because they've just said, haven't they, the 50th anniversary of CFAX, and they've just gone and they've compiled, they've taken all of the pages and they're putting them into like a database, into the history archives. So something people want to do. But yeah, what a fascinating, I mean, literally that was the internet before it was even invented, wasn't it, really? That's how people looked at the stock price. I remember my granddad sitting in front of his, you know, TV, pressing 419 or whatever and bringing up all the share prices at the end of the day. And it's the only way you could check, really, unless you were in the city.
Did you ever try and book a holiday that way? that was scary.
Quick, it's gone. Hold.
Yeah. I want to Greece. I want to go to Greece.
The battery's gone on the remote control, yeah.
Oh, no, we've got 24 pages now until it comes back round again.
Oh, on the holidays, it was like 271 pages. If you missed it, that was it.
I can remember once, in my early days of trading, I had a Skipton share dealing account. For some reason, I bought shares in Skeshly Dry Cleaning. Don't ask me why. But anyway, the price was showing on the teletext. So I bought the shares and I'm waiting for the share price to come around. And it dropped about 10%. I thought, crust. So that was my first foray into buying and selling shares. It was, learned an awful lot from that process. But when I started looking around for resources, you know, with the advent of the internet and the growth in that area, there was nothing really. Okay, so yeah, I think Interactive Investor and Motley Fool and ADVFM, but it was all a bit dull. So I thought it needs livening up a bit. So it's Share Crazy. Just came about as a way of demystifying the whole process. You know, I'd realized it was a fairly pretty straightforward process. So Share Crazy came about, and a lot of companies trying to market websites had these marketing devices such as characters or whatever. And I went to an investor show in London, and there was this company called iTruffle. They're long gone now. But anyway, they had a big spongy pig that was wandering around, and it was at the event. So anyway, we decided to invent this character, Joe Public. And Joe Public was this giant character. And my son actually wore the outfit to various investor shows that we went to, you know, and it scared the living daylights out of old ladies. But it was actually very effective. It was a good marketing device. And Joe was on the website. Of course, the moderator on the bulletin board was Joe Public. And it just kind of really worked well and hung together. So, yeah, we sold that on in 2007. Sadly, the company that acquired the Share Crazy, they had a fire at their offices, and poor old Joe went up in smoke, so he was never seen again. So that was that. But then we launched Brand Communications. You know, we got a database, we got good contacts with the press. So we started working with brokers, helping them to get their brand out there. You know, we had writers that would be right for the head of dealing at that particular company, and we'd just help them get the message out. Yeah. And that was very effective too. Started working with Zach Mira around that time too. Zach was doing a lot of writing for us on the website, and then of course he evolved, became the front for Tip TV, did a lot of CEO interviews. we started that too. We then started representing small companies on the website and across our channels. And of course, the podcasting, the interviews, everything that we do today really grew from that point.
Yeah. And how has the landscape changed in that time? You know, you've been doing this since the early 2000s. You've obviously seen the crash, the heady days of the Lehman's, you know, when it all came down in sort of 2008, 2009. But how has the landscape changed in sort of since the inception of real social media with the likes of Telegram groups, you know, all the Facebook pages that you have? How has your job changed from that sort of writing and getting journalists involved and putting it in maybe like the Midas and getting it in the columns, to how you put the content out now?
We still do what we've always done. And I think it's very easy to get sidetracked and get pulled into new media. And we are there. We are represented across various channels. But I think more than anything, it's just the longevity of some of the PR companies in the city. They're there because it's a bit like McDonald's. You walk in, you know what you're going to get. And people come to brand comms and they know exactly what we're going to provide for them. But it has changed, and now there are an awful lot more people in the space, a lot of commentators. You know, some are poachers turned gamekeeper, if you like. You know, you see a lot of guys who started out having a social media profile. I mean, Doc Holliday, Mike, is a good example of that. He's now moved on to the board of ECR and is doing a very good job there. So a lot of very knowledgeable people in the space sharing their information around. But yeah, we've always got a viewpoint, a commentary, an idea, some speculation, if you like. But we'll always, our commentary and our editorial is always pretty good. And we prided ourselves on that. So that's the bedrock on which we do everything. And, you know, that's what we'll continue doing.
Very good. So tell us one incredible success story that you've had in the last sort of couple of decades. One that you'd rather not talk about, but we I'll talk about it because it's good fun. Because we've had some of them as well.
Oh, I've had plenty of those. Well, I think probably still today, the most spectacular return to date was back in the early noughties. There was, with the advent of computer gaming, there was a company called Rage Software. I don't know if you guys remember that at all. And this was, goodness me, must be, it was at the start of the dot-com boom, and when we had these big old computer boxes and computer games were in their infancy. And they launched this space shoot-em-up game called Incoming, and it just really resonated. Sales went through the roof. People were talking about it. It was huge. It was getting loads of press coverage. And we got in, I think, at a quarter of a penny, and then it went up to 2 to 3 to 5 to 10. And then they launched a football game sponsored by David Beckham, and it went through the roof. And we were, you know, selling out 70, 80p and sold most of it. And then shortly after that, the company went into administration. So
what, one of Beckham's successes rather than cellular goods then, isn't it?
Well, exactly. Yeah. One of his successes, you know, scored a great goal with that. So yeah, that was great. But I think that was.
So that proves that this market and any market is all about timing. Because as you said, you could have lost the whole shooting match because it went into administration.
Yeah, there was another company called Energis around the same time that was spun off from the National Grid, and heavily invested into that. And out of the blue, the company had the blood pool that went into administration. That was all back in at the same time. So yeah, that I was really sort of caught with my trousers down at that point. But I think the last few years, you know, it's been a really, really tough in the resource space, and the market at the moment doesn't seem to be working properly. So I had a long discussion with Zach yesterday about this, and we were just talking about the markets and where it's at. Because we're just drifting at the moment, there's very little direction. I mean, we've got the US election coming up, so that's going to be a macro factor that's going to impact on the markets. And then we now have this new Labour government in place, and there just seems to be a barrage of negativity on social media about what the new government are going to do. But, you know, they were elected, they're in place. Yeah, they're going to make changes. Yes, they're charging VAT on school fees, you know, as a way. That's Labour's way of, I suppose, you know, punching below the belt the upper middle classes where their kids are private school. Equally, they're means testing the heating allowance for old people for winter. So, and actually, I have to think that's a sensible thing because there are plenty of old people out there who don't need that heating allowance.
Yeah, whereas I said the same thing and it didn't go down very well. But
no,
I think
no.
there's We didn't need, there's 9 million people or something that didn't need it. They really didn't need it.
Exactly. And yes, it was nice to have it, but they don't actually need it. So the money should go where it's most needed. Yes, it's saving government money, so that money can be redirected elsewhere. I'm fine with it. I'm really fine with it. But the Twitter's become quite a toxic place.
Very toxic now, isn't it? X has become, I think, since Musk, it's actually not an enjoyable place to be around, is it? It felt, you know, all the posts seem to be just right wing, and everything is just fascist. It's not, it's vitriolic at the moment.
It is. It's almost like, it's like sort of, Trump ideology is being prosecuted by, the right wing representatives across the world. They're all just these profiles, and you're constantly seeing this stuff. You know, and it's just there. So, I mean, for us, we just dip in and dip out and, use it for the purposes that we need to use it for. I will, in my own right, occasionally post an opinion and a thought and a comment, but that's as far as it goes. So,
I saw an article, just coming back to your point about Labour and affecting things and obviously how it'll affect the market. So it was a good article we were reading yesterday. And one of the quotes was, Rachel Reeves may be on the verge of doing irrecoverable damage to the AIM market and creating market chaos for smaller companies. And this is about removing the tax incentives, like the EIS from AIM. What are your thoughts on that and how that will impact? Because AIM's pretty much a dying market, as we've seen all these companies delisting and going private. Do you think this could be the death knell to AIM if she does something like this?
I think it could well be. It does concern me, but I think the government are intent on turning this country into a cotton wool nanny state. So decisions made by individuals about where they can invest their money or where they shouldn't invest their money, that's been taken away from them. And part of the process of destroying the AIM market or the destruction we're seeing in the AIM market and across markets at the moment is part of that process. Is that the longer term agenda? I think it is, but I think there is still a market there, and there will be a market there if something happened, if there's a major global event. I mean, we saw with COVID, resource stocks came alive. So it will take a major macro event to move things or perhaps create a new opportunity. And we're seeing gold at the moment. The gold price is shooting up, but it's not really translating into the prices of gold stocks. Now that valuation gap could be closed at any time. That we could all of a sudden see that change. That there could be a realization that that's the best way to get exposure. And gold may, if you're investing in gold now into an ETF or if you're buying it physically, you might think the price has gone too high. But it could be argued that if you want exposure to that market and you want to have upside opportunity, you could get into some gold stocks now because the gold stocks are lagging behind. So
yeah, I was looking at the GDH is obviously the big guys in the gold mining sector, and in the last year that's up about 40%. GDXJ, which is the junior one, is up about a similar amount, actually, just 41%. And that was actually before yesterday, so maybe they're up again today. But that has to only be the beginning of a re-rate when you talk about the guts of $1,000 increase in price of gold. And all of that is going to the bottom line. Pretty much all of it anyway, let's say 80 to 90% of it. So you've got to say that producers have got to be something that's going to be looking good. And then the next course of action then is when does it tumble down to the explorers because they're all digging the gold out and they need to be refilled. And yet there are many options in the UK market. You've got Conroy Gold, I'm sure you're appropriate to one of them as well. GMET also now doing fire assays for gold as well, and Pilot Mountain, Desert Scheelite. So yeah, I think gold is going to be a big theme, but I also think copper is going to be a big theme as well. I was listening to a podcast yesterday for an hour, I think I sent it to you, with Robert Friedland in it. It's a very interesting one. And, he's just saying to the analysts, guys, you got to throw your old analyst playbook out the window. Because it's not going to work going forward with the copper. We don't have enough. And if we don't have enough, then there has to be another way forward. And we're going to have higher prices for a long time for these people to say, okay, I'm willing to invest, $500 million in this mine to make it work. So yeah, it's going to be very interesting. But give us an idea of some of the gold miners that you're involved with.
Sure. Well, I think it's well known that I've been working with, or we've been working with ECR for a long time, ECR Minerals. And again, you know, the developments across the board from that company. Of course, there was a big management change, very sad, sadly, a few years ago. Craig Brown, the chief executive, died, and it was a major shock to everyone. And of course, the reset button was hit. The existing chairman, Andrew Scott, Trevor Davenport, stayed around. And then, of course, Andrew Haythorpe came in, steadied the ship for a while. And September, almost a year ago, in fact, Nick Tulloch came in as an executive director, and Mike Whitlow, Doc Holliday, joined the company as chief commercial officer. And of course, subsequently, Nick has now become chairman. David Tang has left. And Mike has come in as... has now joined the board as managing director. So they have a raft of projects across Australia. Some of them have been going for a long time, and the results have been okay, but the team really have the bit between their teeth now. And I'm just going to go through, there was an update on the Australia projects a week or so ago. They have a project starting in Queensland. There are two projects, the Lulworth project, which is, it's in a region where the former gold mine, the Charter Towers gold mine that produced gold some years ago, also the Pajingo mine, lots of smaller workings and historical workings around the area. And they've worked across these three licensed areas. And Adam Jones, the geologist on the ground and the team, they've undertaken painstaking soil sampling, trenching work, and they've gradually narrowed it down, and they've now identified prospects where they believe the potential for the gold exists, and wonderfully named the Uncle Terry prospect. You always get these weird, wonderful names out in Australia. But at this prospect, they've the rock chip sampling. They found a rock chip sampling there, 75.6 grams of gold from a chip, which has looked pretty healthy. And Adam and the team doing more work there at present. Then you move further south from there to an area, to a project called Blue Mountain. Now, this was something that team bought from, well, it was when Andrew Haythorpe was in charge, and did deal with Blue Cubble, and Darren Hazelwood was also had an interest in that holding too. But Blue Mountain is the Denny Gully gold project. The guys have been there undertaking trenching work, and from the trenching they trenched and processed 15.5 cubic meters, 9.95 grams of visible gold were recovered from that. Best samples were 197.1 grams per ton and 97.4 grams per ton. So the team are progressing with that, and they've just renewed the licenses there. They will commence a drill program shortly. We then go down to Victoria, which is where the historical old operations of ECR have been based. Important to understand too, the company owned two properties. It still has one property. It sold a property early this year. It has a property in Creswick, and they've just applied for planning permission, and they will then sell that piece of ground. And that's probably going to be worth about just over $500,000 Australian when it sells. It might even be a bit more. So in terms of funding, the company is fully funded for all of its activities this year. It also has tax losses from the Australian operating company, Mercator Gold, up to $75 million Australian. So those are currently being marketed at present. And of course, if those tax losses are sold on, which is often the case in circumstances like these, then it's going to generate a significant amount of money for the company, which will, of course, go back into exploration. But also Victoria, just worth noting two further developments. At Bayliston, they re-examined some drill core. And, of course, antimony, there's a lot of antimony mining in the area. They discovered a substantial antimony find, 0.3 metres at 32% antimony. And, of course, the commercial requirement is just over 1%.
Usually, but where you have antimony, you have gold as well, don't you, generally? That's an indicator.
Yeah, the antimony has been banned now, hasn't it? Or the export of it from China, it's been banned into the US. So there's going to be a big demand for antimony. And it's required for the defence industry as well, isn't it? Because one of the things in the 1800s, I think, in Conroy and Tribrook, they had an antimony mine there, and then they discovered the gold via that, if you like. So, it's an interesting one. There's some characters in ECR Minerals. You've got Nick Tulloch, obviously, Voyager.
Yep.
Voyager, and he's now joined the Chilbrands as well, and he's going to be helping them, I think, in terms of coming back after the debacle that we've seen from the American directors that has happened. You've also got Andrew Scott. How's he managed to appear from there, Mr. Media on Proactive?
Well, Andrew was asked to join the board by Craig Brown back in 2021, early 2021. And of course, Craig died in October 21. So Andrew was on the board, but he just brings his media skills to the table there and has also done a lot of background work in sourcing projects and also working alongside Andrew Haythorpe when he was with the team. But he's certainly helping to move things forward. And of course, today we had the announcement of the other project in Victoria, which is the Tambo project, the historic gold mine there, the Duke of Cornwall mine. And they discovered a 51.5 grams per ton sample there. And if you look at the social media post on Twitter, you can see where the samples were collected from, and they're all similar numbers. So there's a lot of potential there. Drilling is about to start, so that should be very exciting. And of course,
I do like ECR in the fact that it always seemed like a company historically who didn't have much direction. But I think since Nick and Mike have come on board, it seems like they're massively focused on getting all this work done. As you say, they've announced the contractor engagement for drilling at the Tambo project, which will get underway. They've done some rock chip sampling, which they're very encouraged with. And it does feel like they're on the way to proving up some good assets there.
You're absolutely right, Phil. But I think more importantly, just as importantly, they've actually got the company back on an even keel, because when they were looking at raising money, this is last year when Mike and Nick first came in, they'd actually run out of headroom. They weren't able to raise all the money needed. So, of course, they had to change. They had to, change the share structure. That was done. And then, of course, Nick and Mike raised the money that was needed at the time, but it was done outside of the market. So it was in a sense, retail investors and certain high net worths all participated, put the money in at 17.5p. And of course, it's been well ahead of that ever since. It's touched 40p since, 44p in fact, since they've been in charge. Currently 0.23p, and you've got a company with all these assets that's worth just 4.3 million. But since Nick and Mike joined, so say that the share structure has been sorted. Also, they had a lot of historical assets. I mentioned the property. There's the other property they're selling to. They sold a lot of plant. They had the Midas drill rig that was sold, a new drill rig that was ordered from China that was sold, and they're receiving monthly payments of $33,000 a month for that rig. And so in terms of financially structuring the company and ensuring it's on the even keel financially, they're fully funded for all the activities. And of course, both Nick and Mike are taking their fees in shares, so it's they're absolutely aligned with shareholders. And I think that's why ECR, with its raft of projects, with everything that's happening, there's a very good chance, I think, something substantial is going to happen with one of these projects.
So Mike Whitlow is Doc Holliday.
He's indeed, yes.
Okay, just so everybody understands that and see him on social media. I mean, from my perspective, what is the market cap of ECR?
4.3 million as we speak.
Okay, so it's 4.3 million. Has it got any job reports, of any of the assets that it has in the ground as yet?
It has no JORC.
Defined resources.
Resource estimate in place, yeah. But
so they're still in the process of the drilling and trying to get those resources in place?
That's right, yeah. But I think with each of the projects, there's something advancing substantially on each project. So, if you're looking, if the company just had the one project and they were a one-trick pony, then there would be concerns, unless, of course, the project was further advanced and had a JORC resource already attached to it. But no, where they are, they've got four projects underway, and they've got an additional license up in northern Queensland too, which is adjacent to an old license they had an option to buy, which they didn't take up, called the Hurricane Project. So that's still in the mix too.
Okay, very good. Sounds like it deserves some digging around to see what's involved and listening to. You have some past interviews with just ECR, so people can tune in and listen to what the guys have been saying.
Yes, indeed. If you go to the Brandcom's website, select ECR on the drop-down menus, you'll see a lot of those interviews there. But
great.
They're also on our YouTube channel as well. So yeah.
And really, it seems very lowly valued for all the assets being in Australia anyway, that's for sure. you know.
It does, Gavin. Yeah, and I think, but that's symptomatic of the current market disconnect, isn't it? Really, I know there's. It's. I think unless there's rapid progress and news flow building on news flow, and ECR have driven the news flow really hard this year, and it's really benefited them. But I think we spoke about Guardian Metal Resources. That's been a classic example of delivering great news flow just at the time it's needed, and the share price is built and built and built. And
that momentum you need, isn't it, to keep
the momentum has been there. Yeah.
There's nothing worse than seeing companies that you look back, you look through the history and think they haven't had an RNS for 8 months. It's like, hello, is anybody actually doing it? You know what I mean? You've got to keep that constant news flow.
And the CEO's got to be in the public eye all the time. It's got to be active on social media and be seen.
But I want to come back to this as well, because the reality of resource place is that you cannot put content, as in continual important news, out, because mining doesn't work like that. It doesn't, it's not like, oh, we did this on the computer and everything's hunky-dory. No, you've got to actually have people physically moving either a drill rig, thousands upon thousands of tons of overburden or whatever it happens to be to get to the resource or build a mine, etc. I mean, I think some people who go into the market initially in resource sectors really do think, because we sharply sometimes think that all of these things happen quickly. I mean, you're obviously longer in the tooth than we are. So what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think if you want to see how quickly these projects progress, I think Sovereign Metals, and of course, we both know Sapan, well, with Sapan for a long time, and that company has just got the most incredible asset in Casilla. It's, it's the size of a small country, the actual resource area. And of course, it's still expanding as the exploration areas are open on strike to the north and the south. 1.8 billion tons of rutile and of course, graphite. I think there's 17.9 million tons of contained rutile and 24.4 million tons of contained graphite. And of course, we've seen the pictures on social media with spherical graphite processor being set up at Casilla. So progress is great, but it's taken, so they had to conduct the pilot phase through the open pit mine that's been created there. The process of excavation, the process of actually getting down there, doing the work, getting it out, setting up the infrastructure, the rail links there have been improved. The Malawian government has improved the rail link that runs right through Casilla. So from a logistical standpoint, the ore can be transported out of Casilla into the Nacala corridor, of course, and then to the deep water port. But this has been going on for several years. And of course, the share price for Sovereign has moved up with the Rio Tinto investment, which was a fantastic endorsement for the company. But it has taken a lot of time. And, I think a lot of people thought when Rio first came in, great, the share price is going to go to the moon. Well, it did go up, but it didn't go up a huge amount. It's been valued by some of the brokers and investment banks have written about it many times ahead of where it is now. In fact, one Australian tip sheet actually reckoned that Sovereign Metals was going to be the next Fortescue Metals. They just got this enormous asset and everything was falling into place. And the thing is, with Sovereign, everything has fallen into place pretty much. They've got a progressive farming initiative there, which they're working with local farmers to improve the yield from the crops, obviously investing into educational community. They're employing the local community and educating the community so they can actually work on the site. But that process takes years. And although everything is falling into place, the grades, the quality of the graphite has been proven to be battery grade. So one of the largest, this is going to be one of the largest resources of graphite in the world. And of course, you've got rutile, which is the source of titanium dioxide, for your white paint, for your optics, for the aerospace industry, and so on. But it's even so, that the process of actually getting it from where it is now through to the final completion of the DFS, that's where Rio have come in to assist them. And of course, Rio used to take in long-term views. Funnily enough, we were talking Anglesey Mining, the chief executive of Anglesey Mining, who I know, Rob Marsden. He's also former Rio. He headed up the Rio Tinto Investment Committee. and you know, basically going around the world and looking at projects for Rio to invest into. So he's very au fait with that process, having worked there for years. But Rio invested, it's great, but it's not really, it hasn't really lit the share price up as many expected. But I'm certainly invested into Sovereign, you know, I'm a long-term holder there because I think it could genuinely be a multi-bagger from the circle.
Yeah, and did you see the news recently that they presented at the Mineral Security Partnership at the UN General Assembly, which I thought was excellent. Well, there was a panel discussion, I think, which was Mining Titans and New Horizons with the Rio Tinto CEO, Jacob Status, and Sovereign's chairman, Ben Stojkovic. So yeah. I'd like to actually see that conversation at some point. I'm not sure whether it's actually been posted yet, but I'm sure SAPAN will share once that has been recorded and edited.
Yep, indeed. And of course, strong support from the Malawian government. President Chakwera, of course, addressed the UN Assembly and, you know, discussed, well, presented briefly the case for Kasia, you know, and Kasia is going to really change the country. It's going to be a huge boost to the economy. So, and they're very supportive of mining projects. Of course, they're very supportive of Makanga's project in the region too, Makanga Resources. So.
Do you think there's something in the share prices that people are reticent? Because if I go and buy a 1p stock or a half p stock, I can maybe buy a million shares. If I want to go and buy a Sovereign Metal, well, maybe I'll only get 10,000 or I'll only get 20,000. Do you think there is a rather crazy psychology in that scenario?
It's called greed, Kev, because they want millions of little babies, don't they?
You're absolutely right.
To me that I think this is something that holds people back sometimes. It's like, I don't want to pay 35.
They feel like they're not in at that basement level, don't they, if it's at 35, because it could drop 35 levels, whereas if they get in at underground, under the first floor...
Well, if it gets to a penny, it could drop 0.00003.
I know, but they don't look at it like that. They just think they think if it's a penny, it can only drop to one level, whereas if it's 35p, it can drop 34 levels or 35.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're both absolutely right. Absolutely right. It's that midway, isn't it? It's the middle ground. So you're either invested into small caps, and you know you're buying your 4 or 5 million market cap companies, buying millions of shares at 2p or 1p or half a b or whatever. And then of course you go to the other extent, you buy Rio Tinto and you stick that in. And I've made, you know, in my SIP, I've made a lot of money from Rio over the years, and of course it always pays a dividend too, so that's very useful. So I think people are quite happy with both of those, but a halfway house stock like Sovereign is a little more difficult to quantify, because you're right, Phil, you know, it could, you know, if something goes horribly wrong, the company's now got a market cap of about 250 million, so that's quite substantial. But as we both know, you know, from here, really, given the value and the demand, given that, you know, countries won't be buying from China, the demand is going to propel the price of graphite and the price of retail higher. So Sovereign are in a very strong position. And I think, you know, the company has genuinely got a chance to multi-bag from here. What's going to take it higher, I don't know. But I think it's as it nears that production phase and they start shipping stuff out to market, then we should see everything go gangbusters at that point.
Yeah, it's got a market cap today, 209 million. I said, I think one of the podcasts we had with Charles, I was saying I think it has a very good chance of becoming a £1 billion company.
Oh, yeah.
And he was like, no, it's much more. But it potentially is much more. But at the same time, Rio is the likely buyer, whether we like it or not. You know, with already 20% shareholder, and a one-person auction is never as good as, you know, a few jumping in to try and buy Rio stake off them as well. So I think if you put it in mind, if you bought a 2 million market cap company and it became 10 million, you'd be very happy. It's the same thing. So just think about it from that perspective.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing with another Nort on it, or another few Norts.
Yeah, I mean, I was interested in Rick Rule's, you know, he's been to observation on, because we had him on a few weeks ago, and we asked him about Sovereign, and he was like, he was excited about it, but he said that unfortunately Rio has taken away some of the shine, because the upside with them is that he may only get double back on his investment now from this point on. Whereas if it was someone else, because he said it was like they're 20 meters ahead in a 100 meter race, which is a great summary. You know, they've got that head start. So there's not really going to be a bidding war. It's almost like they've got the upper hand. So they're going to control any valuation if they go for a buyout. So it's kind of the upside has been removed by Rio.
Well, the upside's been removed, but you could argue if Rio hadn't invested that the share price might be a lot lower now, because you're looking for security.
It doesn't give it the seal of credibility, does it?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. You know, if it's endorsed by Rio, then that's what else do you need? You know, it's endorsed the project. But I agree. I think it's turned it. It's removed a lot of the risk from investing into sovereign, but at the same time, it's also removed a lot of the upside too. But I think there's still a lot of further upside there. And I think I agree, Kevin. I think to get it to a £1 billion valuation, you know, say in a year's time, maybe before then, is not unrealistic at all. Had Rio not been involved, or if there were, say a plethora of, Vail or Rio or Billiton all invested into the company in what way, shape or form, then that would of course be better.
Yeah, with Sovereign, I expect that I think the net present value of that is $5.6 billion. And I fully expect that that will increase well into the $2 billion and plus rate region. And to put that in perspective, will Rio pay £800 million for something that could basically produce for the next 100 years? Well, I think the likelihood is yes, and that would be a fivefold increase in the sovereign value.
Yeah.
It could be more. It could be more, and it could be less. But we know the asset's there. We know it's good. They know it's good. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken 20% of the company. And as you say, a very de-risk play. And I don't think that Sovereign Metal are going to sell it to them for the current market price.
No, I agree with you. I mean, so Rio stuck nearly $60 million into Sovereign. Last quarterly report, Sovereign has $50 million at the bank, so they're in a very strong financial position too, outstanding. So they're not under pressure to sell. They've executed the first part of the deal, but yeah, I think they'll be looking for an awful lot more. And I very much hope that Ben Storkovich and the guys actually look at this. Of course, they've got Frank Eager, who's now involved as well as managing director on the ground there. So, I hope between them they all put their heads together and come up with a figure that's well north of $1 billion.
Okay, let's have a look somewhere a bit closer to home. It's one that I've been interested in, but I want to learn a little bit more from you, Alan, because I know you've been to site there. It's Anglesey Mining. The Paris Mountain Mine is one of the projects, and I believe it's copper, zinc, lead and silver from memory. Just talk us through what you've seen there and what put this on your radar, really, and why maybe people should start looking into it.
So this is a fascinating site and play, and I was really pleased to have the chance to go up the last year. I know some of the former board members, and sadly, Dinesh Verma, who was on the board, passed away a few weeks ago. But his son, Dilip, was very active with Anglesey. And I went up with some analysts last December to look at the mine, and it's the most incredible place. It's the headframe is quite visible from a long way away. It's called Paris Mountain, of course, the project. Mining's been underway there in one way, shape or form since the Bronze Age. It's a really, really old mine. And part of it was an open pit mine. That's the touristy bit, if you like. So you can go there and you've got this, what's almost a lunar landscape. It's a reddish lunar landscape. And it's been used as a film set for lots of different things. Mortal Kombat, it was used as the film set there. But of course, when it rains, all of the oxide and stuff seeps down into the local rivers. So there is a pollution issue which is dealt with. Historically, there was a channel dug into the bay, out into the bay there, just off the northeast coast of Anglesey. And ships used to come and moor there, old sailing boats, and they'd moor there for a couple of weeks. And of course, the toxicity in the water had the net effect of cleaning all the barnacles off the hull. So, if you like, it was a free scrape and service for the ships. So there's all this has been going on. Mining there in the 70s, always been copper. There's been zinc, lead. It's a polymetallic asset. In the core shed there, we saw some of the old core from the mining that took place all those years ago. But under the stewardship of the Joe Battersill, who is still on the board there as a non-exec, the company started to explore to the north of the headframe under certain zones where there's an old historical engine room, the engine room, and then, of course, the Garth Daniels and an area called the Northern Copper Zone. Drilling took place. There was a big drilling campaign last year, and the core that came up confirmed this huge geological anomaly between 400 to 600 meters. So it was about 200 meters thick. You know, this core was coming out of the ground, chock full of chalcopyrite and fool's gold and all sorts of stuff. So the assays from those have come back. They've confirmed good grades, commercial grades. And so plans are underway. The company also was looking for a chief executive after Joe stepped down to go and work for Silver Mines in Australia. And they brought in Rob Marsden. And Rob, of course, Rob mentioned Rob just now. He formerly worked for Rio Tinto on the running the investment board there. And he's come in. He's a mining analyst in his own right. And he's very meticulous. He's undertaking the series of studies to initiate the PFS and upgrade the resource that's currently there. And the company was featured heavily across BBC and ITV a few weeks ago. With the work that's underway, they're seeking to reissue mining permits. There's a lot of support from the local community. You know, if you have a cab ride in Lockerbie, which is the local town, the cabbies are very supportive of the project. There's an issue, I think, with one landowner, but that's now been more or less resolved. So it's a question of getting the mining permits issued, getting the infrastructure in place. There's a road route that's been agreed to transport the ore to the port at Holyhead. Traffic through the ports has dropped since Brexit. It's down about 35%. So there's a jetty there, which is pretty much a plug-and-play solution. So they can actually get the ore to the port, load it onto the boat, and away you go. So everything is there. But of course, they've got to basically drill a new shaft down, drill a processing, put the processing plant together. The land is there to do that. In fact, the infrastructure is there to do that, but they're going to need to raise an awful lot of money a bit further down the road.
Do you think it'll ever become commercial? I mean, obviously, as you said, it's an old mine. I mean, obviously, you know, we've seen old mines come back into production. We've seen the likes of the Cornish tin mines being repurposed, Cornish Mining, Cornish Lithium. Do you think there's any possibility that the likes of Alba Minerals and Anglesey can ever produce the likes of these minerals we need?
I think I'm not so familiar with Alba, but certainly from what I saw at the site and what Rob and the team have done since that time, I think there's a very strong probability that mine will be recommissioned, brought back to life. It requires a lot of infrastructure to be built and to be put into place, but it is there. It's literally a plug-and-play solution. Now, we need copper. So the copper grades that are coming up are very strong indeed. And of course, all of the other metals that are there in the ground with the copper. But it's the permitting process. It's dealing with the waste. Everything that has to go with building a mine in today's environment. But
yeah,
if you look at...
They've just done an EIA, haven't they? A scoping report and everything, and submitted that as well. So it's all, you know, building up to... And it's a big milestone for Anglesey.
Oh, it's a huge milestone, it was always there. But Rob Marsden has, because of his approach and his experience with Rio, I think he's very meticulous and progressive. It's progressing, but perhaps not at the pace that he or the team would like. But of course, you have to go through the processes of getting all the boxes ticked before you can progress on to the next level. But the company said in the RNS today that they've just raised another small amount of money, which sits very much at odds with what's actually there. But it's the post-aid market at present. We've got something like this that you're trying to get across the line. You've got to get it to a certain stage before you can attract the big money. And of course, if it's PFS ready with an upgraded resource, which it will be, then at that point, you're going to, and of course, with the permits issued, then of course, you're going to be able to go and raise the money in the market or perhaps get some funds involved. Another option, which I think the company will also be looking at, is perhaps to the UK Infrastructure Bank, of course, forwarded 25 million quid onto Cornish Lithium last year. That was non-dilutive. So that's another option Anglesey could look at. But I think if it gets to PFS phase with the upgraded resource and all the permits in place, then UK Infrastructure Bank, I'm sure, will be looking very closely at providing money to Anglesey to hopefully ultimately recommission the mine.
Yeah, it brings back a lot of memories. I used to go on family holidays through Conway, Llandudno, and we used to stay at a place called Pemmermaer, which was only a few miles away from the island of Anglesey.
So, yep. Yeah.
My parents had a caravan on Anglesey as well later in their life. So, yeah, it will really make a big difference in that area, I think, in terms of employment and stuff, if they can manage to pull it off.
Yeah, there's the support from the local MPs too, and it'll create lots of employment that will really sort of help to build the Anglesey economy. But yeah, it's a lovely area, Kevin. I mean, as you guys probably know, I do a lot of motorcycle touring, so I like getting on the bike and riding around North Wales. There's some.
You need to do the Anglesey circuit, because I took the car up there last year and did the actual Anglesey track
day,
and it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you'd like your bike touring, and they used to have all the bikers doing what they call the Evo Triangle up there, didn't they? But they've now put speed cameras at every single part of the road, and the Welsh have absolutely gone crazy on speed, haven't they? They were the ones who introduced the 20 miles an hour in most of the little towns and villages. But some of the roads through the Breckens and into Anglesey around there are phenomenal, aren't they?
It's beautiful. Yeah, I mean, there's a lovely loop around Snowdonia. And in fact, I know Jim Williams well, who the former chief executive of years ago, Ariane Silver. And Jim is currently chairman of VVV Resources. We also work with them as well. Jim's lives in Conwy. He's a very keen biker too. So my son and I met Jim up there last year. We were staying at Bala, a funny old hotel in Bala there. And yeah, we went for a spin to Lake Ogwen. There's a great coffee shop there. But yeah, it's spectacular. It really is.
So moving on to away from the resource sector for a minute, because I think we're both covering a company called Electric Target that came to the market at 2.1p and until today, or until Friday, was languishing at 0.65p and worth sort of £1.5 million, which is just completely bizarre considering what's been happening in terms of the news. Now, it's not about Electric Guitars, so what's your thoughts?
It's an interesting name for a company, but you know, it's of course we're at this Web3 juncture now, aren't we? Where permission-based marketing has taken a quantum leap forward. Historically, of course, you surf around the net, you go to Facebook or Twitter or wherever you go, and the browser will pass your cookies information on to that provider, and then you'll start seeing ads according to your interests. But of course, you know, it's got to the point now where that data is then collected and it's resold, and it's resold, you know, millions of times per day. You know, the database is always up for sale. So this data is collected without the permission of the user. So that's all changing. That'll be switched off. You know, cookies will no longer go on your hard drive. So when you look at a website or when you look at a product, you will have to, or you'll be able to tell the company what you want to tell them and nothing more. And the company, the onus is on the company to interact with you in the way that you want to be interacted with. So it's called Electric Guitar is all about people first data. And they're working with a raft of companies in order to provide this. They recently, of course, started working with Juicens, the builders merchant, to improve their interaction with the end users, their customers. So with people first data, the Electric Guitar PLC owns Three Radical and Three Radical Vocia, which is the platform that's behind the people first data movement. They're working with a lot of companies in the financial sector and helping them to market in an effective way and a non-intrusive way to consumers. They've just announced today, of course, they've launched a loyalty app to leverage open banking data. And I really sense with the company now that the story is starting to gather pace. It was, when it came to market, it was a bit slow, not a great deal happened, but we've seen over the past 6 to 8 weeks, new deals announced, new cooperations, collaborations, partnerships, and it's really starting to gather pace. And I think it's going to be I think the company's going to be judged on its numbers at the end of it, you know, the cash it's generating. And I think that's probably what's holding the share price back now. But so I interviewed, of course, John Regan, as I know you have, and also Richard Horwood, the chief operating officer. And, you know, both are incredibly bullish about the prospects. And, of course, with something like this, if you're first to market, even though people might not immediately understand and grasp the concept of what you're trying to do, the fact is that Electric Guitar are very visible, very first to market in this area. As things gather pace, we're going to see the share price certainly return back to IPO levels and hopefully beyond that.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I think we're going to have some movement there. I mean, it's silly cheap in terms of what a tech company with AI involved with it with already connections. And I mean, they're not hiding the fact they're gonna buy and grow. So this is not in any doubt that they're gonna be adding other, excuse me, revenue lines through what they're doing. But it seems to be the Three Radical is really making moves now, and I think I have a regular RNSs now to show all the different products and different relationships that have been created.
Yep.
And I mean, John doesn't say it in one interview that they have a deal down in Asia with a credit card company, and it's not Visa. So just so I don't get in trouble, I'll obviously say it, but there's only Visa and another one. So any sort of sniff of expansion of that could be extremely exciting. If they have one corner of the globe and they end up having the whole globe in terms of that, yes, we could be onto an absolute winner. You talk about companies 5 or 10 bagging. Ask yourself, could electric guitar be worth 15 million pounds? Because then you've 10 bagged from here.
Indeed, we're looking at a market cap even with them today at just over 2 million quid, which is nothing, considering the sort of blue chip customers the company are working with already. I think a lot of people will wait until they see the numbers in the results, and I think that's it probably the way the company generates cash isn't entirely clear, so they need to, I think, articulate that better. But I have spoken with John and Richard about this, and I'm sure we're going to see a lot more news on that front, and details in regard to trading and revenue generation in the not too distant future.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think if this business was in the US, nobody would even be worrying about that. It would
I
be
know. Yeah.
buy, build, buy, build, buy, build, and then
If it
you
were
would have.
NASDAQ, it would be a 50 million pound company already. No, no question.
Yeah, which is bizarre, like 25 times what it's worth at the moment. And the reality is they'd then be in a position where they could buy and build much quicker and much bigger. And they would get there much faster, but we don't have that mentality, okay, yet. But I think people are starting to realize now that these tech companies need a lot of capital, and as they produce the capital, they will produce the revenues. So it's chicken and egg time, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Hey, well, Alan, we've talked long enough. I mean, I hope you've enjoyed your time here. We've had some good conversation there. How's it been?
That's been great. Yeah, it's been great speaking with you guys, and I like your stuff. It's a very informal and informative environment you guys are creating here, so well done.
So, we have to ask you the question because you're on the Sunday roast. What is your favorite Sunday roast?
Well, my favorite Sunday roast would have to be roast beef or horseradish. And also, my wife does these parsnips with honey and marmite. Try that.
Nice.
Honey
What
and
about
marmite?
honey and
Marmite.
marmite? Oh yeah, oh yeah,
What
honey and
about
marmite.
Yorkshire puddings though as well? Do you have some Yorkies?
Yeah, we've got to have the Yorkshire puddings. Yeah, love the Yorkshire puddings, and there's a pub around here that does a Yorkshire pudding full of sausages and gravy and mash and all the rest of it. So that's a
So
treat
the
sometimes.
question is, for the horseradish, are we talking about, rocket fuel horseradish, or are we talking about the cream stuff?
A creamed horseradish, I think. Yeah,
Yeah, with you there.
yeah.
You've got to
It's
take your head off. It's got to be one of them
no
where you
one's to
regret
cry.
running up your wasabi
Yeah,
nose.
wasabi does. Yeah.
No, it's definitely
Yeah,
creamed
yeah,
horseradish for me.
yeah, yeah.
Just adds that nice tang to whatever you have.
And
Excellent.
a good glass of Merlot with it too.
Indeed. Indeed.
Good.
Very good. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking to you anyway. At least come on again at some point and we can wax lyrical. I mean, sure, there was many stocks we didn't talk about, and we both obviously cover Golden Metal Resources as well, but we've talked about them a lot in the last while. But I think good buying opportunity there for anybody just at the minute, with a bit of a wobble in the share price as we talk on Friday back up to 27p. I think there's been another report today also about, or not report, another thing from the US government, Department of Defense, putting out their presentation showing PSF tungsten by the end of the year. So again, if this comes off, I think it'll be much, much higher.
Okay.
Well, that's good because I've still got some more warrants to exercise, so I'll be looking forward to that.
On that
Very
note,
good.
we'll say Alan Green, CEO of Brand UK. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Kevin. It's been great. Enjoyed it.
Thanks.
Okay, so let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. We've had Kora Gold up 77%, and ironically, we were talking about this earlier, Kev, that you'd think it would be a gold play, but it's actually up. They had an update on exploration at its Sanankora Gold Project in southern Mali. The 2024 exploration program identified 8 gold-bearing structures across 50 kilometres of prospective terrain, outlining 20 new and existing greenfield targets. All targets are within reach of the proposed Sanankoro processing plant. CEO Bert Munro expressed optimism about growing the resource base and extending the project's life. So great to see some actual gold stocks moving up. Another one that's got some gold, a gold play, is Global Petroleum. Obviously, they're a Namibia-based oil and gas play, but they've also got assets in Western Australia. They were up some 50% on news that it had applied for 2 further exploration licenses adjacent to the current exploration license they have already there in Western Australia by the wholly owned subsidiary of Juno Gold Pty Limited. So looking good with gold, as I say now, and of course the Namibian excellence. So give me your thoughts on those.
I've been watching the Global Petroleum one. I haven't really watched the other one, to be honest. But the Global Petroleum one from about 0.9 and about 10 days ago, and I was pretty sure because there was a group collecting themselves and thinking this has got to go up, this has got to go up. And then the other news came that they got more licenses in Australia as well. And it's the same, or one of the people that I think basically was part of the team that discovered Havieron for Greatland Gold.
Yeah.
And it also plays into this. We were talking about this waxing lyrical, that what does this mean for Greatland Gold? Because Greatland Gold effectively is going to have first say on all of these things, because it's going to have the processing capacity with Telfer. And, you could find that offers start coming
in. I think Greatland Gold, it could potentially become a company that starts making acquisitions in this
year. Yes, absolutely. And I think that's what's got people excited, because, nothing has physically happened, I don't think, in Global Petroleum. And if it really does start to happen, then we're going to have to change the name on it. Because Global Petroleum.
Global Gold.
And then we've got other plays like, and I mentioned it last week as well, Conroy Gold, not moved at all. If anything, it's gone down. So it just depends the position that they're in.
Yeah.
We're talking the price of gold has gone up to $2,650, roughly, dollars per ounce. The dollar index is hovering around 100. It did dip below it slightly after they increased the interest rate. You've got silver making a bit of a run.
Was it about 32 now, was it?
It went up to over 32, and then it's just dropped back down again to around 31.
It's doing better, isn't 0.8. It? I mean, it's got a long way to go, but certainly I remember when it was hovering around the mid-20s and trying to break through the 30s, but it seems like it's gone through the 30s now.
And you've got US dollar or GBP against US dollar has gone up to 1.34. If you remember the good old conservative crisis when it went down to, almost parity. I think people were buying at 105, 106, 107. So, from those heady days we've had an all-time high on the Dow Jones, only on Friday, I think. So
copper's doing well. It's moving through the 10,000.
Yeah, copper's moving very well now, 4.6 roughly to the pound. And as you say, just over 10,000, with the futures looking strong as well in terms of LME prices in excess of 10,000 for the next number of months.
Yeah.
So that was a wobble on the old copper. We've seen Greatland Gold looking pretty strong at in and around the 7p mark.
What did you make of that RNS? Because obviously they announced significant progress, obviously, on completing the acquisition of the 70% stake in Havieron Gold Copper Project and the 100% ownership of the Telfer Gold Copper Mine from Newmont. 2 key conditions for the acquisition, including the remediation of Telfer's Tailing Storage Facility 8, TSF-8, and the restart of processing operations. Newmont has completed the required TSF-8 remediation, and processing at Telfer resumed on the 23rd of September. While the conditions are not yet fully satisfied, the acquisition is on track for completion in Q4 2024. So I thought that was a great update.
Yeah, no, fantastic update. And if that means the whole of Q4, they're effectively going to be producing revenue, how does that change Greatland's position? It's like it fundamentally changes it. you know, and allows them to have probably free cash flow now that they've got the money to put into all sorts of different projects and things, including obviously bringing Havieron on as well. What were your thoughts on ECR Minerals then?
Obviously, yeah, I mean, it was good to talk to Alan there. And obviously, I know Mike Whitlaw, Doc, as he mentioned, has been waxing lyrical, as he would, being now managing director of the company. I like it. I mean, I don't know a massive amount about the assets.
He's COO, really good. Chief Operating Officer, isn't he?
Yeah, he was COO and now he's been made to managing director.
Oh,
yeah, okay. So basically, the assets they've got, I think, are really good. As you said, there's no actual JORC resources on them, but it's all about proving them up. And I think I want to learn more about them. And I think we'll try and get Doc on at some point to maybe talk us through, and you can go into all the different situations there. Bezant Resources, I don't know if you saw that, they announced the renewal. It was obviously the exploration license, EPL 6605, for the Holkengårdgruvan copper gold project in Namibia. Obviously, it's the one they're waiting for, but it's not the one they're waiting for in terms of the actual production license. But what are your thoughts on that? It's another step towards the puzzle, isn't
it? Yeah, another step. I mean, we just need the flipping mining license, no harm to you. So it's like, it's just frustrating. To get the mining license, that's a game changer for that stock.
And we've been to that site, haven't we, Holkengårdgruvan? Yeah. And it is just not far off in terms of once the license is there, then they can get the ore out.
Yeah, it's not ready to go as such, but it's going to be good. And we had a couple of good updates from Electric Guitar this week. Obviously, Electric Guitar, nothing to do with Electric Guitar. And Alan was talking about that one as well. We had news from BSF Enterprise. They were on the roast last week. Yeah, that one to me looks very, very interesting. That, you know, if they get some sort of deal on the leather, then it really could change the company. And the other thing would be a deal on the city mix for the meat, and they seem to be in negotiations for that. So let's see. I had a chat with Callum Somerton this week as well for Chill Brands. So all is moving forward. Can't really say much more than that, but all is moving forward. He's very optimistic about what's ahead. So, watch this space in terms of that. What else is anything
else? Incantera had an RNS, didn't they, on, I think it was Thursday. Basically, they provided an update on the launch of the Skin Plus Cell. It was initially planned for September 2024 in 60 Marienrod stores in Switzerland and Austria. And obviously, the launch will now be expanded across Marienrod's broader European retail network. 1,200 stores following discussions with Marienrod and AS Watson Group. Production orders of 350,000 units will support this wider rollout, anticipated to generate revenues exceeding £10 million. And I think everything is, I mean, obviously it's frustrating that there has been a perceived delay, but actually ultimately it's better news because they're actually going out across a broader European network of now 1,200 stores as opposed to the 60 in the initial release.
Yeah, it's one of those glass half full, glass half empty, isn't it? Now, sadly, in the market that we're in, few people have taken it as glass half empty. For me, I think it's a little disappointing, obviously, that it's going to be delayed, but you're going to need 2-3 times the amount of stock for 1,200 stores as opposed to 60 stores. So I think that what you're going to see is an instant boost to revenues, maybe not in the 24-25 year, but in the 25-26 year, which I think is April to April, you're going to see an instant uptick. And if you look at the note and the investor note that was put out, you know, that was to have somewhere in the region of, I think, 20 plus million of revenue. And this alone could achieve that without expansion into Asia, which is also to come, and without any other deals anywhere else in the world. You know, so if this catches on, I'm still very, very optimistic that this will be an absolutely superb investment over the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah. Okay. The other one I want to bring to your attention, I don't think it's anyone we've ever actually mentioned. We've included it in our Rose News Service, the RNS reports that we write. A company called Sulnox, they're on AQIS, SNOX is the ticker. And they're a green tech innovation company focused on reducing emissions and fuel costs. Basically, they've secured two new patents this week, one in Chile and one in Japan. So they actually hit two different countries, which now adds to the existing patents in the US, Europe, and other regions. And it covers a range of products. I think it includes one called the Barrel trademark 6446 heavy sulfur fuel oils emulsifier and Solnox eco fuel conditioners, which improve performance across diesel, petrol, biofuels, and marine fuels. And that's their first entry into the South American and obviously the Japanese market. So very, very interesting technology. I don't know if you know much about it, but it's about all about reducing emissions, reducing sulfur content in, you know, especially in the marine area where some of these big, you know, cruise ships and container ships are one of the biggest polluters in the world for, you know, noxious diesel engines that pump out really high emissions. So really interesting technology, and I think this company is really going places. So that one really piqued my interest.
Yeah.
There was also something from First Class Metals. We will, yeah. There's also something from First Class Metals, two updates, one regarding the OJEP fund grant, and the other one regarding an update on the dead otter gold trend in Ontario, confirming that there's the, I think they did the photon assay results, and they highlighted a new area of gold anomaly along the 3.7-kilometer strike. And the findings suggested, I don't really know, maybe we need to get Mark on to explain this, because I think the market really didn't understand it. A spotty gold distribution rather than coarse gold, with pathfinder elements playing a crucial role in understanding the mineralization. CEO Mark Sale emphasized the discovery's significance for continued exploration of the trend. So the market, I don't know how
it's, I don't know whether whether the RNS was just a red herring, because basically somebody sold out something in the region of magnitude of 3.2 to 4 million shares that morning, and they ditched some of them at 1.3p when it was traded at 2.9p the day before. So somebody has like literally wet the bed in terms of needing to get out or just doing it regardless, which really hasn't helped. It's obviously had an overhang in the share price and stuff, but I think pretty unwarranted, to be honest, after raising the money previously.
Absolutely. At
2.7 and 2.8p. So, I think, you know, the RNS was really just a holding RNS before the results come.
Yeah,
so
we need to get Mark back on at some point, for sure. The one we do, I mean, I did allude at the top of the hour there, the reason why we're down in Zambia, and I can't go unmentioned that we're obviously going to go and visit Jubilee Metals. They had an RNS in the week, which highlighted an update on the copper strategy in Zambia, which obviously, as we know, they're aiming for this capacity of 25,000 tons, supported by the Sable refinery and the Roan concentrate. And we will go and see Roan in near Ndola, which we're going to do
Monday.
So there will be a report from that. So any Jubilee, anyone interested in Jubilee, please listen back for next week's roast, because we will be doing some voice notes from site. And we're also on the way up there, we're going to see this new Munkoyo open pit operations, which are ramping up as per the RNS, which are going to target 15,000 tons of ore per month, which will then feed into the Sable refinery as well. So very exciting times with the project and the other project, which is actually not, I think it's Project A, isn't it, which actually doesn't have an official name yet, but Munkoyo is the one that they're really, really ramping up operations. So exciting times on that.
Yeah, and while we're here, I've been in touch with Lincoln from Firing Strategic. He's actually in Australia at the minute, but we're going to be 45 minutes away from that, so maybe we will get a chance to call in and actually see the lime processing plant and the quick lime. So
operations are really, really moving forward.
Watch
quite
this space in terms of that. We're not going to the northwest this time, anyway, for the explorers, for Galileo, African Pioneer, and Extract. I noticed Extract got absolutely battered this week for no apparent reason. That was like, again, another bizarre one. Really, and I have to say it, the liquidity because of the Greatland Gold 100 million that was required has been absolutely sucked out of the market.
Yep.
The number of shares that have sort of gone down to lows because obviously those sells were required for people to to buy into Gradient Gold has been quite amazing, really, to be honest, when you see it. What will happen to Gradient Gold then when all these shares come on the market?
Well, I know Charles has been saying that he wants to, and not wants to, but he thinks that it will drop down to the issuance price of 4.8 pence. And if that's the case, he's going to be scooping them up. I personally think that this price now that we're at, this around this 7 pence mark, is where the future valuation of the company is, when these new, you know, this extra issuance of X number of 13 billion shares is going to be hitting the market around the end of September into early October. But we'll find out, won't we? I mean, obviously there will be some churn there, because there will be people taking advantage of any profits that are be, especially in this market, there will be some profit taking. But I think that they will be bought up in quick order. So that's my thoughts on it.
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody's going to be sitting on their hands waiting for 4.8p.
No.
Or below. But you never know.
Stranger things have happened.
You just never know in this market. But I think a huge amount of the money that was put in it is long-term money, and people are going to be holding it. So
yeah,
we'll see.
Well, I think we've talked enough. We've mentioned quite a few stocks. One thing I will say is that if anyone wants to recommend a stock for us to take a look at, please just email us or DM, send us a message on whether it be X or even via Telegram, and we'll do our best to research it and even reach out to the company to try and have a CEO or an MD on the podcast, and then we can delve into it. Because it's always nice, you know, to find new stories out there. There's that many shares. So anything you like the look of, send us an email with a sort of why it's an interesting company, bit of background information, and we'll do a bit of extra research on it, and we'll try and bring the company to you. On that note, I think it's time for bed. Busy week ahead, and thanks for listening. Please do subscribe. Hit the bell icon so you get any future notifications of any further episodes.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.